Hello and welcome to The Human Interface, brought to you by the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. This is a podcast about how developments in technology impact our work and life, as told through the research and insights of a brilliant roster of experts and industry practitioners from the university and beyond. I'm your host, Veena McCool. AI is reshaping every sector of the economy, but what does this mean for today's workforce and the skills they need to bring into their careers? In this episode, we explore what actually matters in today's job market, which AI skills matter, how to think about acquiring them, and where institutions and governments can lead the charge in shaping how AI fits in the future of work. Dr. Fabian Stefani is a lecturer and researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute and author of the forthcoming book, Skilled, which argues that today's biggest labor market challenges can be understood through the lens of skills, and that the skills gap has knock-on effects on wages, employment, and economic mobility. Prateek Sibal specializes in digital transformation in the communication and information sector at UNESCO and can offer an insight into what AI upskilling looks like inside public institutions. Fabian and Prateek, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Veena.
So to get started, we know AI is thought to lead to more productivity, but what does this actually mean for workers and what skills are they expected to bring into the workplaces of today? Fabian, let's start with you.
So first of all, it's important to say there's no one-size-fits-all approach to this. So it's hard to say like, okay, for all workers in the labor market, I give the same recommendation. But there are some aspects that emerge from our research recently here at the OII. And let me focus, in the interest of time, focus on two of them. One is the skills centered around artificial intelligence. And when I say this, I want to explicitly stress this is not only technical skills. So I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, how to develop AI, being a machine learning engineer, but AI, when I say AI skills, I also mean skills as a person in sales, in marketing, in research, in admin, that allow you to facilitate your work, whatever you're doing, and integrate technology into this. And the other stream, what we see, maybe surprisingly to people, but if you think about it, it's not such a big surprise, is so-called complementary skills. So that are skills where the technology is not great at compared to a human being, which would be, for example, team management or ethical judgment. And we see that the more AIs entering certain industries and occupations, the more we see that these skills are being not only more demanded, but also more rewarded. So those would be at least two groups of skills that I think are safe to recommend to, I guess, almost everybody.
And I think even before we go into what is the impact on workers, the debate around productivity improvements with the use of AI is not settled. There's a lot of evidence which still needs to be developed to say, actually, there is a productivity improvement in the economy. And the questions that we need to ask is, what amount of that improvement in productivity is also translating into improved wages for workers? So I think these are some broader questions that first we need to ask. And then specifically to the workers, I think there is a lot of discussion around cognitive atrophy, which we need to take care about because we are talking about medium to long-term well-being of workers. So there's a lot of push around efficiency and use AI tools for your workplace. But then if you are not thinking about worker well-being, this is not good for societies. We need to focus on that. The second thing is also, I feel that over a period of time, because everything is so much easier to do with AI, we are not thinking so much about what is priority. So that's this double whammy where workers are being asked to do more and more, and people are saying, yes, but just use Gen AI and you should be able to do this in like 10 minutes. But then is it really important for the company, but also for the worker? These are some of the questions that we need to, I think, reflect more deeply upon when we're talking about workers. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I may just jump in on this, because it's really fascinating. There's something that comes up again and again in economic history, which is called so-called Jevons paradox, which essentially just says like, we have the means to be more efficient in doing things. And you could think that in the case of AI, for example, that would lead us to having more free time. But it seems to be currently that the opposite might be the case, right? It's like these tools are readily available and without guidance. And that's what I really like what you said, Prateek. Without guidance, people just throw these tools at everything. And that might lead to the contrary, people feeling that they are busier than before because they now get things done probably arguably faster and maybe at higher quality, but they're also in certain circumstances being demanded for just doing more. So it's not necessarily the case that AI is going to improve well-being in the sense that, oh, I'll get my things done quicker and at a similar or maybe higher quality and have more leisure time afterwards.
Absolutely. And that's a bit in the history of automation. Like more and more we start using digital technologies, life becomes easier for sure, but then it is not freeing us time. So now you go to the supermarket and do your own checkout, or you do your own check-in for the flights or the hotels. This is more work which is easier to do, so it gets piled on to you, which was supposed to be part of someone's job before.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying this is bad or good, but I think we just need to be conscious of where we are heading and what do we want, and then decide consciously, yes, this is the future we are okay with.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's been so much in the news recently about the impact of AI skills and what that has done for things like the graduate job market, or how that has kind of concentrated the number of tasks that any given person does, as you said, Fabian, in their roles. What does that mean for actual vacancies? So I guess if I was a job seeker and, you know, I wanted to increase my chances of finding work, perhaps, what options do I have and where should I really be focusing?
There are two things that are emerging right now in the research that we see around, particularly around entrance jobs, like entry jobs, people graduating and trying to find their first footing, their first job on the labor market. One is, and there's been a widely cited paper by colleagues at Stanford around Eric Brynjolfsson, where they looked at how entry-level jobs, the demand for entry-level jobs has been apparently declined. They tried to causally relate this to AI, which there's certain caveats around this study, but let's assume that AI plays a certain role in this, because there is an economic incentive for firms, particularly when it comes to entry-level jobs, to say, okay, we might want to automate away some of these jobs, because the tasks that entry-level people, if you all think about the first jobs that we had or the first internships that we had, those are relatively confined, commoditized, you know, clearly described tasks. And we know that AI is really good at these commoditized, neatly defined tasks. But in the long run, it might ultimately backfire, right? Because the people, the junior people today are the mid-level management and the senior management people in 5 to 10 years. So I'll be cautious when it comes to saying like, okay, you can automate away these roles for various reasons. The other thing that we see in research where we are, I guess, at the forefront of this at the OII with our latest study is that we do see that the prospects of finding a job are significantly higher for people who have AI skills, where we, to keep things short, we ran an experiment with recruiters around the question of like, who would you invite to an interview from the UK, Germany, and the US? And essentially what we see is that if people have AI skills on their CV, and particularly if they have a certificate on AI skills, I hope we can talk about this maybe later in this episode, we see that the chances of being invited to the interview are significantly higher. And the most interesting thing for me as an author of this study is that this is also apparently compensating disadvantages of age or lower levels of formal education, where people are sometimes even have higher chances than their higher educated counterpart or their younger counterpart in this kind of experiment.
And actually, at UNESCO, we are looking at this from the public sector side of things. And we are trying to understand how are jobs changing in the public sector? What are the new skills you need in the public sector to first govern AI and manage digital transformation more generally? And here we are seeing the emergence of a new kind of a profile. So you don't necessarily need to be a technical expert on AI, but what you need probably is a combination of skills, some bit of technical knowledge. So if you're procuring an AI system, you at least know to ask the vendor, what is the accuracy of the AI system that you want? Then you also need to think about service design and delivery. So how do you integrate AI in the whole public-centered service that you're developing, or even an internal service? A lot of times, this aspect of the users is totally missed out. And this leads to basically public services being developed and never used, or it's a real pain to use them. And the third aspect that we are seeing in terms of skills is around AI governance. So are you able to do an ethical impact assessment of an AI tool or not? There are numerous examples where governments have used AI tools. I think there was a municipality in Norway somewhere which decided to close schools because they used a Gen AI tool which hallucinated and provided fictitious evidence. So there are serious repercussions of using AI in the public sector. So you need to prepare your managers with the right kind of governance skill for this technology. So if you have people who have these three aspects, the technical, service design, governance, skills, I think they would be better managers in the public sector, and your quality of services would also improve. So this is a trend that we are seeing in some of the research that we are doing at UNESCO.
Yeah, tell me more about this topic of micro-credentials. It seems to be an interesting and relatively accessible short-term way that people can get upskilled in an industry that's moving very quickly and that they may not necessarily have the resources or bandwidth to necessarily pursue a larger, more traditional academic degree.
I mean, for us, again, the entry point was with the public sector, because we realized that working on AI governance since the past few years, governments are being asked to do more and more, do better procurement, manage and govern AI systems, develop AI tools. But at the end of the day, it's civil servants who are supposed to do this job. Mm-hmm. But they are not supported to actually acquire those skills, but are being asked to do more and more. So we worked actually with the Side Business School here at the University of Oxford to develop a massive open online course on AI and digital transformation for government. And the idea here was to take some of these competencies that I talked about and turn them into practical tasks that people can do using AI. So if you are a communications person in government, how can you use AI to simplify a notice that you're going to publish in newspaper? Instead of saying, you are hereby informed and so on, but how to make it more kind of interactive and easier for people to engage with government? There are numerous tasks like this that we try to simplify across the work cycle of a government official through this course. And there, I mean, the uptake has been really encouraging. We have, as we speak, since about past 4 months, we have 30,000 civil servants from 192 countries who are taking this course. And we have demand for more governments saying, I want to make this course available in Hungarian or in Khmer or in Ukrainian, because they really see the value of this 12-hour long learning program and how it really is designed for this specific audience, and it changes the way they do their work.
If I hear you say 12 hours, you know, you might think, like, if you're listening to this, you might think, okay, 12 hours, how are 12 hours ever going to change my job prospects or the things that I learn about artificial intelligence or how to improve my job with AI? I think actually this makes a tremendous difference. I mean, looking at the study that I mentioned earlier, we see the real differences in terms of, you know, whether AI skills boost your chances of being invited to an interview, they often kick in when people have certain certificates. And from an economist's point of view, it's pretty clear. It's kind of signaling theory, particularly for the cases where we had these disadvantages designed. So we had candidates that had a master's degree competing against candidates who did not have a master's degree. And of course, if we didn't change anything about the scenario, we see that the people with a master's degree have, on average, always the higher chances of being invited, because a master's degree sends a signal, you know, people learn something at university, they have a credential for the skills that they acquired. Once we add AI skills for the people who are disadvantaged in a sense, who do not have the master's degree, it changes the odds in their favor slightly. But once we add a certificate, and that could be one of these courses, you know, 12, you said 12 hours, right?
Yeah.
12 hours. Maybe also slightly longer, a week or 2 weeks, they're not only at the same level, they are in some cases even at a higher level of chances of being invited to the interview. And it's pretty clear, you know, they lack the signal, the formal signal previously, they now have a formal signal for AI skills, and then the tide shifts.
And I think just beyond the AI aspect, it also signals curiosity, openness to learn and challenge yourself, which a lot of people in the workplace are looking for, because technology change is quite rapid. And people want a workforce that is committed to learning and growth. And not everyone can go back and do a master's every few years. So micro-credentials are a great way for people to upskill and signal that to the market.
And also the question is, like, is a master's degree the right kind of vehicle to do that, right? Because if you think about a master's degree, 1 year master's degree, if I think about our students, of course, they get great technical knowledge in our master's program at the OII, but they often, you know, it's very time intensive because they are building networks, they're meeting people, you know, it's a life experience. While for some of the things that you described, it's more relevant probably to have these technical skills, right? To know what AI can do and know about the limitations of this technology. And I think this is something that can very efficiently be delivered in the course of, for example, a day-long or a week-long or maybe month-long class. Yeah.
So far, this conversation is making me think about where the onus lies here. Is it on me as an employee or a professional to kind of, as you say, signal to the market by enrolling myself in a course like this? Or is it actually someone else who's responsible for closing the skills gap at work? I'm curious what you think about that. You know, is it down to the individual? Is it down to employers, governments in your case, Prateek?
So I think individuals have a role to play to upskill, but at the same time, institutions need to create that enabling space. When you're talking about technology adoption, let me take the example of the judiciary. We work with them quite a bit, and we did a survey where we asked them, how are you using AI? We have a network of 36,000 judicial actors around the world, and they came back, about 44% of them said that they are using AI on a daily basis, some for search, some for legal drafting, and so on. But only 9% had received any kind of institutional guidance or training to actually do so. And then there are a lot of cases where you have, for instance, in Colombia, a judge used ChatGPT to decide whether a child should get disability benefits or not. What this does is, this lack of institutional guidance, is that you have a certain set of people who are under extreme work pressure, mm-hmm. and they want to use AI and what we are calling shadow AI mm-hmm. use, even if it's not authorized, to get the job done. And then there are, at the other end, people who are totally scared because there is no guidance and they don't want to touch an AI system. In both cases, the institution loses. In the former, you lose because, well, you could actually make a lot of mistakes and trust in, for instance, the judiciary would decline if a judge is doing that. In the latter, there are some opportunities of using AI to make your life easier as a judge. You are probably not using it. So the institutions need to step in and provide guidance on how to use AI. But even beyond that, I think institutions have a key role to, staying with my example of the judiciary, a judge is not going to sit and do an algorithmic impact assessment yeah. or an ethical impact assessment on an AI tool. You as an institution need to have the resources in the department or whatever people to actually do that. And then the judge is supported and say, okay, I can use this tool and this is authorized by my institution and so on. So I think it's a two-way space where the individuals have a role, but institutions have a mega role to play, which is often not very clearly thought about in institutions.
Yeah, and I fully agree with this. If you think about it, maybe that's a good point to sort of advertise the book a little bit that I wrote. But frankly speaking, if you zoom out a little bit, we talk about AI here and the mismatch, the labor market mismatch in terms of the skills that are being required or increasingly required on the labor market, and the skills that people have is already big when we only speak about this aspect. But this is just one of multiple changes that we're seeing on the labor market. To add a few more, it would be greening of the economy. You know, we need more solar panels, we need more refurbished homes. Retiring baby boomers, there are tens of thousands of baby boomers retiring every week in the UK or in the United States, for example. And this changes the labor market composition tremendously and widens the skill gap even more. And if you look at these numbers, you immediately realize it cannot be only on the individual or only on the institutions. Everybody has to play a role if we want to manage this probably biggest challenge, at least from my point of view, biggest challenge, economic challenge that we have right now in front of us, from the individual over to schools, to universities, to governmental institutions. I think the case that you made here with the judiciary is a really strong one, yeah.
And I think beyond just talking about specific technology, we often forget in digital transformation that there's a transformation aspect of things, which requires a cultural change. In institutions, you need a strong level of leadership support. And we did a study where we saw that about 51% of chief information officers in government said, well, we are actually blocked because the decision-making processes are so siloed. And one department is doing something and the other is doing something else, and there's absolutely no coordination. These are really institutional problems, which technology is not going to come and fix. Yeah. Mm. Maybe you can be helped with better communication tools, but you need to think deeply about the design of these institutions and how they organize workflow and processes. Without that, going back to the first point, you will have a lot of AI use, but it will probably not lead to productivity improvement yeah. because it is for low-hanging things where you're maybe doing a spell check or correcting the text, but not really for a wholesale reorganization of tasks to free up more time yeah. also.
Or it might lead to improvement for some people, but there might be a majority even of people that are left behind because it requires these institutional changes, but also kind of a change of a mindset. You know, is learning something that I aspire throughout my life, right? There are still many people in the labor market who've grown up in a time where you had this so-called front-loading in learning. You go to school, go to university, you finish with a degree eventually at, I don't know, the age of, in your mid-20s, And then you stick with the same job or maybe even the same company for the rest of your career. And there's relatively little learning going on. And I think if you look at this with a sober perspective, it's clear to all of us that those times are over, right?
Absolutely. And here we see that the incentive structure is a key space to think about in the public sector, because it's exactly this mindset that, okay, I am now a civil servant. I have this job for life. What do I do? You are not really motivated to invest in upskilling. You have a lot of supply side, you know, interventions. You have courses, trainings available, but why do you do it? So I think governments are now also thinking about how to incentivize people, whether some places it's about creating digital units and then picking up within government people who have a certain set of digital skills, AI literacy, to kind of join those units. It is, again, a signal. And for that, you need to think of the incentive structure in government and the competency frameworks that they have in government, which need to be updated to reflect what changes AI or digital transformation afford in our civil services.
Mm. Okay, so what I gather there is it takes both sides. It takes, yes, the willingness and the appetite to reshape one's own skills landscape as an employee, maybe some incentives in place, but it also takes an institution setting the tone from the top down and in some cases leading the way. And I'm curious, if we kind of move to practical advice here, like how do employers or institutions set the tone for this type of AI transformation and lead the way for their people?
I mean, there are numerous examples here. First is really to understand from the people what are the tasks and the processes that they are involved in. Oftentimes, we've seen that there is a brilliant idea in the IT department or some vendors are pushing a particular tool and say, okay, this is an imagined need that our people have. And then that tool is pushed in the organization. But the people who are actually working, they realize that, okay, they first have to now migrate to a totally different tool that probably they did not need or it does not fully meet their expectations. So first part of any kind of digital transformation journey in, for instance, the public sector, anywhere else actually, is to go to and talk to the people that you're working with and ask them, what are your needs? What are your pain points? I would even, you know, rely on some design thinking approaches and they say, what are the pain points when you are interacting with XYZ service or product? Mm-hmm. How do you feel? Because that's the phase where you're doing the discovery and trying to find ideas and problems. This is not even like finding the solution. A lot of times we're just so fixated on, I have the solution, but maybe that's not the problem that you wanted to solve in the first place. So really first go and do that. Once you do that, then you start after this discovery phase, slowly defining what is the problem. And then you potentially build solutions. And this would in some cases look like maybe I've understood the problems and I need an AI strategy for my organization, link it with the different aspects of HR, upskilling, and so on for the people. And then maybe you have some semblance of a digital transformation plan in place. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if I think about this question, I probably think about two things. One is skills and one is technology. And you could look at this from having a pessimistic point of view and say, like, there's increasing inequality in the world because there's some actors who very well already understood, with the example of AI, to navigate around these two poles of skills and technology. Many big tech companies do because they've built these tools in-house and they know both how to integrate the technology into efficiently along all of these, the things that you said, particularly into the workflows. And they also understood how to keep their workforce afloat when it comes to skills. I don't want to take this pessimistic point of view. I'd rather like to see this as an opportunity because this shows us there are best practices that work, right? Both on a company level, also on a government level. There are governments, usually, you know, the typical digital leaders like Estonia, for example, that manage to move ahead with regard to both technology and skills. And I think often it comes back when things do not work. It comes back to a lack of guidance, for example. Companies, particularly small and medium-sized enterprises, overestimate the costs of having a system in-house, like an AI system in-house, because of course there are privacy concerns, there are data breach concerns, there are also environmental concerns. And that is often due to these concerns are kind of exaggerated because people for example, overestimate the costs. They think it costs much more to install a system in-house than it actually does. And the other one is guidance, right? Often when we talk to people in companies, you mentioned the shadow use of AI. So employees not using artificial intelligence or secretly using artificial intelligence because they don't have the guidance. Management doesn't say, we want you to use this. We actually not only want you to use this, we have a tool in-house that you should be using for X, Y, Z according to the skills and the problems that you have. And I think that's particularly for firms, the backbone of the economy in countries like the UK, but also the US and in Germany, the smaller medium-sized enterprises, to have this kind of guidance and lead the way, management leading the way for the workforce.
So if we kind of take this back to where we started today's conversation, we've covered so much here in terms of the public sector, in terms of the skills gap. What does all of this mean for the future of skill building in the modern workforce?
From my point of view, I mean, running a group here at the OIR called SkillScale, you're not surprised to hear me say that skills is probably maybe one of the most important ways to leverage all of this and help to shape a sustainable future. When it comes to skills, though, interestingly, we very, very often lack the first step, which is a map of where we actually are, right? What are the skills that I have? What are the dormant skills that I might be having, the skills from a previous job that I'm not using? And the reason why I'm saying this is because these skills crucially define your adaptability, right? Being able to maybe move to a slightly different role because of technological advancement, because AI is getting better in writing emails, summarizing reports. And if that had been a major part of my work, I obviously need to shift. And some of the skills that I had from a previous role might help in this. And so I think having a clear idea of the skills that people actually possess is kind of the, maybe not the sufficient, but definitely the necessary condition for moving ahead.
And as I was mentioning about this competency framework, Vipin, and here what we tried to do was map out what are the skills needed in the public sector. But these were not only like skills, but also attitudes. So experimentation, openness to collaboration. These things are extremely important when you are working in teams and you want to get things done. And we are actually missing these attitudes in a lot of cases in the public sector. So we argue for first skills around basic data literacy, data-driven decision-making, AI literacy, but also around user centricity. How do you develop an attitude that is user first? How do you think in a more agile manner and not be stuck that, oh, I had a plan and then I executed 1, 2, 3, 4, but you do it in an iterative way. You say, okay, I tried, I test with the users, and then I go back to the drawing board. And I think this attitude, this kind of putting it in practice requires an ability to experiment.
Yeah.
But at the same time, from the institution side, it requires acceptance of failure, which is not something that public institutions are designed for. If you fail, then basically you are held accountable for the damage because it's public money. But I think we are losing something, some innovation in the public sector.
Absolutely.
To even adapt, as you were saying, an AI tool and develop it in-house requires a fair bit of courage to say, I will do it. And maybe there will be some problems, but let me try. And maybe in the medium to long term, it pays off to have an in-house tool in terms of privacy, data protection, and so on.
Yeah.
So we need this experimental mindset also.
Absolutely. This kind of openness is probably one of the most, on the individual and on the organization level, one of the most crucial things, generally speaking, but particularly in a time where we are right now, because things are so uncertain, right? If you talk to the people of the institutions that are often perceived being very successful, big tech companies, for example, mastering this change, that is one of their crucial paradigms. It's like, there's no failure in that sense, right? It's like, whenever you try something, you will definitely fail. That's part of the process. And that is the huge opportunity to learn something. That is, it is an indicator of making progress.
As Nelson Mandela said, it's either you succeed or you learn.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And what I love about what you've both shared there, you know, Fabian, you talked about skills that can adapt and transfer even between jobs. Pratik, you talked about having a willingness to experiment and be open. These are inherently human skills that only we can bring to our jobs. Yes, we're talking about AI, but we're also talking about the almost sharpened role and the responsibilities that we need to take as human employees in today's day and age.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, I mean, we're talking about AI today. In 5 years from now, we might no longer be talking about AI because it's like become like electricity or like, you know, the computer to us in the sense like a general purpose technology. But I don't want to make too many forecasts because I know forecasts in economics notoriously age badly, but we will be talking about change in the future again. And this is essentially a conversation that we're having about change.
Absolutely. I mean, we are all knowledge workers, right? And if you are not curious and not trying different things and experimenting, then what is the point?
Yeah.
You don't innovate. So those attitudes that you mentioned, Veena, are extremely important for us to advance in our careers.
And my last question for both of you as we wrap this up is, you know, what's one thing you'd like the listener who is facing this AI jobs market to take away in terms of skills, in terms of how they run their companies?
All of us feel a lot of pressure and anxiety about artificial intelligence and it taking our jobs. And we've seen whatever little evidence that we have that it has not reached the level where it is so integrated that it is leading to mass layoffs and so on. But there is a whole narrative around it that is extremely anxiety-inducing. So first, we need to calm down and reflect. What we need to do next is really, I think, look at what aligns with your own skills that you have currently. Then try to see what complements those skills and try to branch out and develop those skills. As you were saying, Fabian, what are the complementarities that I can bring?
Yeah.
As an individual, I always think about if I have expertise in one domain, and I want to venture out into a new domain, I think about what do I bring to this adjacent domain while learning about the structure and the knowledge of that particular domain. So I think that's a good place to start while you're finding whatever AI courses you're looking at, not necessarily go deep into, oh, I want to tomorrow start coding or try to build AI apps. Just look at where your skills are and then link it with the adjacent field where you want to grow in.
I think my take would be to say AI is just one of many examples where we see change unfolding rather rapidly. And that's also what I'm saying in Skilled in the book is that where I try to give many examples of change, very challenging situations like the pandemic, for example, or challenging situations like, you know, we need to quickly transition into more sustainable, ecologically more sustainable economy. And this is rapid change. This can be very stressful, particularly if you are guided by, from my point of view, false narratives of dystopian futures. But it's also full of opportunities. There are countless examples for people with the right mindset and the right skills that excelled not despite of this tremendous change, but because of this tremendous change. And that's also certainly true for the age of AI.
Thank you so much, Fabian and Pratik, for joining us on this episode of The Human Interface. Make sure to subscribe to be alerted when new episodes drop on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. And follow the Oxford Internet Institute on LinkedIn and Instagram to stay abreast of our latest research and updates.